Oh, in other news, speaking of tariffs, and check out my sick new swag that I got at Aldi yesterday.
Nice.
Oh my God. It
They're getting on the
looks like their spons.
they're
Wait,
getting
is
on
there
the
an
Kirkland
Aldi?
train.
And it looks
I
like
thought they were a European supermarket. What the fuck is
You don't have all
Aldi?
California? You just got Trader Joe's out there? Are you fucking
Yeah.
kidding me? Dude, it's one of the best.
California's
It's
dirty.
been in the Midwest for like 16 years. I never was on Aldi's. Oh, they do have them
I
down
think
here.
Aldi
I've never heard
and
of them.
I think, dude, I think I want to say Aldi and Trader Joe's, they're like brothers, the owners of those companies or something. Even though I think Aldi was founded in Germany. Aldi, Trader Joe's relationship.
Oh, they are two brothers who founded Aldi, and I guess they branched out. Oh, so this is like the OG Trader Joe's.
Look at that. Yeah, it's almost like a hybrid between Trader Joe's and Costco. So like Trader Joe's, you get like your there's constantly a new kind of there's a fluctuating supply. You've got your like aisles that have the different pickles and the different chocolates and stuff. Except for everything is still like in a box, very utilitarian, very like minimal, very low cost. They cut costs down by just putting boxes out that are filled with shit. And they have very few employees operating these stores, a lot of self-checkouts. So it's kind of like a combination between Costco. It's like the scale philosophy of Costco meets the small scale and variety of Trader Joe's. And they're able to provide products at a really cheap price.
Cool, I'll check it out.
Let's start with utility. I don't understand what it even means.
Everybody has some kind of utils in their head that they're calibrating.
There's hardly anything that hasn't been used for money.
In fact, there may be a fundamental problem in modeling what I want to model.
Game Economist Cast, episode 352.
Take five. All right, we can lead with that. Back from GDC, normal cast, normal crew, energized, refreshed. Ready to talk about AI, ready to get controversial, and also ready to talk about what we've been playing.
Got a selection of good things on sale, stranger.
Oh, you're first.
So I have an interesting one for you guys. I've been playing a game called DC Dark Legion. This is a game by FunPlus company. I was talking about that other podcast where we mentioned that the founders are Chinese, but all of their games are 4X games that have had a lot of success in the West. And they released a new game that I would argue is very similar to modern 4X, but also has a lot of squad RPG elements. You're collecting characters, you're starring them up, but you're also engaging in like these multiplayer PvP maps as you would have in 4X. And I was trying to figure out the thesis, and I think it has to do with basically restricting the size of the revenue waves that normally come with squad RPGs. So normally there's a bunch of spend when players get a character they want or a character is the featured character for that month. It's very dependent on content and how many characters you can push per month. And 4X tends to be steadier because the conflict is steadier, right? It's really about battle for the seat of power. And that tends to have more consistent costs associated with it rather than having this huge fluctuation. And I was basically just trying to think about, could we measure, create a KPI, tell us how wavy or unequal a particular game is? It's obviously the Gini coefficient. Like we should just use the Gini coefficient for daily revenue. And what we can do is we can assign each game a Gini. And if the Gini is high, then we know that they've had a lot of inequality in individual days contributing to the revenue scheme. So I think a game like Genshin would have a very high Gini that has very wide range of revenue, whereas a game like Last War would have a lot more steady because it's
But like,
4X.
what insight
What do you
does
guys
this
think?
give you, knowing that day-to-day revenue is volatile?
I think it presents a novel challenge to solve. Like revenue bouncing that high is an interesting observation that I think you can
Is
play
it
with.
bad? Is it good?
I think having that wild of fluctuation in revenue is not, I don't think anyone wants wild swings like that, right? That's really sensitive to content.
Yeah, but it might just be a reflection of the content and the
But what
way
can you do
value is
about it?
being delivered to players. So I think about this when I look at movies, for example, their revenue is incredibly spike and then tail, spike and then tail, right? But that's just a nature of what the type of content they create and how it gets delivered. And it's not necessarily bad compared to McDonald's, which is like a continuous stream, right? It's just a different model.
Phil, you're saying we could create a revenue volatility index that is basically just the Gini coefficient, i.e., spend
But like,
inequality.
yep, revenue generation in qual days.
It's a KPI. I don't know. I don't know. I think I agree with Eric here. It's what you look at like CPI or ARPDAU, and you can infer from those actions that you might take to try to push them up or down. This one, it's first of all, it's hard to influence spend inequality. That's a very abstract, like concept? Like, how do you pull down top spend? Do you push up bottom spend?
Are you talking about spend inequality between players or just day-to-day spend? Like, spend between days?
Spend between days. So, like, we're measuring a Gini coefficient within each title. So, like, if you looked at Genshin Impact as a really high crest and trough to its revenue wave, because the gacha characters when they're released do so well, and then the drop off after players get it is so large. I think it's to have spiky revenue like that is hard for it to become predictable. Like, those waves are not always as predictable, and it's always just an expensive missile. Like, I think people don't want to take few shots, they want to take a lot more shots. You get more feedback, because if you miss on a character, you miss a huge chunk of revenue, and then your next window is next 2 months.
So I think it's an interesting observation, but I would flip it on its head and say, you've got this content, which is a new Genshin character. How do you extract the most revenue from that content? And if that spike decay pattern is actually the best way to extract revenue from it, then, you know, why not do it? Right? Now, maybe the spike suggests that you could be price discriminating better, have it high priced early on, and then, like, gradually make it more accessible and more cheap later on and smooth out that spike. But I don't see the spike as intrinsically bad. Yes, there's some planning volatility, but an uncertainty.
No, I think that's a fair choice.
So this DC game is, so it's DC as in like the IP, and then it's 4X squad RPG.
Yeah, you're talking
RPG,
about this game at GDC. It's like a mashup of genres, so like DC comics, superheroes.
Yeah, yeah. Very weird, but it seems, the thing is still, there's this great presentation Ethan Levy, who was the other co-host of Deconstructor Fun a while back, had about like this Tower of Want. I want this because I want this because I want this, and how high can you build that tower? And I think this game just really struggles with having a really high tower.
Is it too flat and wide? Or
Yeah, it's too flat. Like, hey, for my characters, I get them to level 400. I'm not quite sure what I'm supposed to do after that. It just feels aimless, and it's very painful with that grind. I need bigger, stronger carrots. But yeah.
I need to try the game out.
Do you recommend people play it? Okay.
Nope.
All right. So, speaking of games that I do recommend you play, Monster Hunter Wilds. And shame on you, Eric, for returning it after you purchased it. Although it's fair enough if you haven't played World. Oh, no. You still have your job, right? But your wife.
We got two private kids in private school and one income. So, private school, it's a subscription. You can't cancel for a whole year.
We'll talk about subscription.
Like in Monster Wilds is the new one?
Yeah, it's the latest Monster Hunter iteration. It's the latest AAA quality Monster Hunter game to come out since Worlds, which was, 2017, 2016, 2018? I don't know. Sometime in there. Monster Hunter is the key contributing factor to me upgrading my system. So I went from the Xbox One to the Xbox One S, Series S when World came out. And then I just upgraded to the X when Wilds came out, because I just can't be having 30 FPS when I'm fighting my monsters. It's not tenable. Anyway, excellent box price premium game, $70. There was a bunch of other DLC types of packs you could buy. I think like the max, I could be completely butchering this. I want to say the most expensive one that I saw was like $99. They have a pretty standard DLC system. So they released the first game. They released the game, and then a year-ish later, 2 years-ish later, they release a major DLC. So they've done this with their last three games, probably more games before that, but that was before I started paying attention to this kind of stuff. So Worlds, they came out with a big update called Iceborne. Sunbreak, which was, Monster Hunter Rise, which was just for the Switch, that was not a AAA. That was more like traditional, back to their roots. Low poly, not super high fidelity, not like a super complex RPG like Worlds and Wilds. They came out with Sunbreak, which is the DLC there. And then with this game, they're going to have some sort of major DLC. The game is amazing. Classic Monster Hunter. Definitely took some getting used to after going from Rise, which was a little bit more, I don't know, if you like picture the super tight mechanics of a fighting game and then compare that to the looser mechanics of an RPG like The Witcher 3. In The Witcher, when you stop moving, your horse like will take a few steps and then it stops, versus like a fighting game, like you stop moving, your character stops immediately. It was like that, where in Rise, which I was playing before, the mechanics were much tighter, much more, okay, you stop, you're done. There's also the polygons were much lower graphical fidelity, so you've got less shit flying around on your screen. So interesting to get used to that. I was actually really surprised by how little content there was. I pretty much finished the entire game and all the quests within 60 hours, which for a Monster Hunter game is, I think that's pretty short. The main storyline is like 25, 30 hours, which again is pretty short. They just released a free content update, but that DLC is going to be coming in probably in a year or so. And that'll be like $40. is usually how they do it. The one thing I don't like about this subscription or this DLC model is for even hardcore players like me, I'm usually burnt out of a Monster Hunter game after 100 to 200 hours, and that's within a year or two. So by the time the DLC comes out, I'm done with the game, and I've never bought
like a
revival
event DLC. For you, where you're like, can't do it.
For me, and maybe it is for most people. I know it works for them. They wouldn't do it otherwise. But yeah, I wonder if there was some way to push up DLC purchasing. Hey, buy the all-in pack, and you get all DLCs from here on out for free. And then you'll have people like me who are like, oh, I'll definitely play the DLC. And I wouldn't have bought it otherwise, but I do buy it because it happens at release. You know what I'm saying? So that's Monster Hunter. Super straightforward monetization model. Nothing fancy. A DLC, maybe they could push up spending by introducing the ability to purchase.
I'm kind of surprised that they haven't
evolved
to a live service loot grinder kind of model, like similar to Path of Exile or Diablo or whatever. Because it's got a similar thing, right? You grind up, you get your better gear, and like the power growth gets super slow over time, and just add more raid bosses at the end for the end game.
That was one of the worries for the community, was because the Wilds is like much more a kind of open world. It was much more of an open world live RPG. Like the map is constantly updating. So it is live service in that way. So you're constantly having new monsters cycle in and out of the map. You're having different quests pop up on your radar with randomized rewards. So it's almost kind of like Destiny, where you have these quests that fluctuate, and then you've got like these big monsters that you can fight on a regular basis that are almost like raids, but they're not monetizing it at all. I think the community would be pretty pissed if they tried to, but it would probably make them a lot of money.
Cool. What have I been playing? So I've actually been playing this recently, but yeah, it's the AI episodes. I figured we should talk about Infinite Craft. Have you guys played this game? It was like a simple web game where you start with four words, earth, air, fire, water, and you combine two of them. And then there's an LLM, like AI, that's a new word. So if you combine fire and earth, you might get lava. And if you combine lava and earth, you might get volcano. And volcano is added to your vocabulary, and you can combine volcano and air, and you might get, I don't know, tornado or something. But it's just a fun, that's all there is. It's just you combine words, it creates a new word, the new word gets added to your vocabulary, you just do this over. And this was trending a couple of years ago.
Wait, hold on. So there's nothing that happens beyond I get added to my vocabulary. Just like a name generator
exactly.
Or the history.
You want to play? Let's play it. Let's play it. It's yeah.
I'm on it right now.
First
what
ever.
If I combine Steam with
Game
Steam?
Economist cast live walkthrough.
I have a cloud.
What
happens if I combine wind with a cloud? I get a storm. Oh, okay.
Yeah.
This is pretty fun. This is cute.
If you've been within 5 seconds, it's probably a good sign.
No. Because I'm the type of person who likes something and I'll go super intense on it for 30 minutes and then I'm like, right. Can't do this anymore. So we've got a storm. Let's make a firestorm.
No, just go for it.
Should I restart?
Oh, volcano. There you go. All right, let's you got a cloud over in your
vocabulary. I lost my clouds.
Right, so you can.
Okay, let's make Mordor. Let's combine earth with volcano. I just got lava. Okay, I've got lava. I've got volcano. I've got earth. I can only ever add. Okay, I feel like I'm just going to end up with a bunch of magma if I don't.
Yeah, you got to get more creative.
Fuck's sake. Is the idea that you...
Try doing...
How? A storm and volcano?
Eruption water. I don't know. Maybe you'll get like faucet. No.
Eruption water. I get lava again. What if I get lava and lava? I get a volcano. What if I do volcano and volcano? I get a mountain.
Mountain and wind?
What?
Do it. Yeah.
I was going to do a cloud, but...
When?
I think there's... I don't know if this one has it, but there's certain goals you can work through. So Mordor. Chris mentioned Mordor. After the podcast, I would challenge you to try to create Mordor in here. You can...
So is that an outcome that...
You can get everything. You can get like Donald Trump 9/11 in here.
Dude, what? they should have like objectives over here.
That's so
you know
easy.
What I'm saying? Like they should have get to blah, blah, blah in...
Yeah. Yeah, there's I think, you know, people make up their own version. And there's probably clones of this that have added meta progression, stuff like that. But yeah, this is a snowman. Yeah, see? Anyway, you can get all sorts of, because it's an LLM, you can generate pretty much anything. It's like kind of that promise of like Scribblenauts or whatever. You set the snowman on fire, it melts it to water.
Shit. Yeah, dude, that did not work in my favor.
But,
I thought it would.
Yeah,
cool,
it really is like an open-ended sandbox.
I thought I'd get like a carrot.
And yeah, I bring it up because I think this is one of those few examples. We talk a lot about AI in terms of, it's going to take away software development jobs or artist jobs. But this is an example where AI is being used as a game mechanic in and of itself. And it can actually create new gameplay and new game designs as a result. I will say after this came out,
this totally convinced me. This is totally convincing. Fucking Eric, again. This is exactly what I wanted to see. It's such a simple proof of concept.
Yeah. I will say I haven't seen anything like this in the last like year and a half since this came out, but It is pretty dope, and I'm sure there's designers out there thinking in this space.
It just needs some light gamification layers. Why do you always drag it on top? Can you make a network?
Yeah, you can drag multiple objects on your anything until you...
Right? What is... But... So what do you can set up recipes almost?
And I will say the recipes aren't fully deterministic, again, because it's an LLM, but yeah.
Dude, I'm convinced everything just results in volcano and lava. That's what it all ends
Chris, let's see if you can get Mordor later today. I guarantee you it's possible.
I'll send it if I can.
But yeah, AI. Today we're mostly going to be talking about it as a productivity tool, like a capital technology, as opposed to a new design. But I think there's some space here.
All right, let's fucking go. Okay. AI debate. I published a piece last week, and I'm basically taking aim at what I am calling the copyrightists, and there may be some amongst us even today. And my criticism of the copyrightists, they assume in a lot of their arguments that AI is copyright infringement, and therefore claim that artists must be paid royalties. It's never really specified how the royalties are to be paid. That's a TBD. That's a big TBD. My problem with this is that it's not clear to me that it's copyright violation. So, for instance, if we use the analogy of an artist who trains in the style of another artist, we would never consider that copyright infringement. And as we know, these LLMs cannot produce the original work, but they do train. Is that really that different than a human artist training on a style? That'd be criticism number one. And criticism number two is really a copyright in general, which is that we've almost never had copyright enforced in games. We had this Nemesis system which launched, and that was patented by WB Games, and everyone decried that. We don't want to see patents in games. Patents are bad. They inhibit our ability to build on top of each other's innovations. And so we see this best illustrated in games once again. And I think that applies here. I think human beings are going to create no matter what. So I think I take aim against all together.
Do you see a difference between mechanism copyright and IP copyright? So if I were to create a piece of art that's in the exact style of Studio Ghibli, is that the same type of infringement as me creating a all-in-hole game where you suck things into your hole? Are those two things the same? Is that the same, like, wrong? Assuming that we're, like, trying to disprove that this is wrong, are those two a part of the same universe?
For the purposes of this conversation, I would say yes.
So you think that,
an IP.
So what about Pokemon? Should I just make, if I want to make a Pokemon fighting game, I can just make it, and companies should not have the rights to sue me and say, hey, you're stealing our IP?
So what I would say in situations like that is that I think consumers will crave the original content. Like, it's not just using the characters, it's other things. Like, we know there are, like, seals of approval between something that's authentic and original and something that's not. So I think that while that content will exist, the original pieces of content will still exist and still continue to be profitable even in the face of it, just like we see with counterfeits.
They're saying
today.
No, that they should not be able to protect the Pokemon intellectual property.
No.
What about consumer confusion? This is the classic trademark counterfeit issue. What about consumers who think that they're buying an authentic Pokemon game, but they're buying Eric's Pokemon knockoff?
So I would like point to like sneakers. Like, this is a big thing in like the world of sneakers, if you're familiar. Selling Air Jordans is that there's a lot of counterfeits. So this is like giving rise to all these third-party marketplaces where you send the shoes to them first, they authenticate it, and then they resell it. And part of it is they have the buyer guarantee because they authenticated it originally. And so I think the market just solves problems like this pretty naturally. And so
So you're like a radical, like, anti-intellectual property stance.
So I used to be, when I was on Team Econ, Team Hardcore UChicago Econ, I heard this argument before and I was like, no fucking way. Like, it reduces the incentive to create, right? That is the huge problem with getting rid of this. You can't be that stupid. I think that when you balance that against the successive building on top that happens in innovation, like it happens in trees, that you have one innovation, which is based on another innovation, that when you slow down that process because you have copyright, that is such a huge deterrent to growth that it overwhelms the incentive effect. Like, ultimately, human beings always create. Like, it's pretty inelastic in demand or quantity supplied from a change in price, I would argue.
So I think that the best way to approach this is from damages. Like, if you were litigating this, you would just look at, like, the damages that were dealt to Nintendo or Pokemon Company, and you would evaluate, oh, how much do you owe them for copyright infringement? This is like kind of the Pareto efficiency or Pareto model, where you like try to solve such that nobody could be made better off. And I think that the problem with So that's how I think you would be able to say whether it's good or bad, is what would the benefit, what would the overall social welfare of the economy be if there was no copyright laws versus if there are copyright laws? And it's not really a counterfactual you can actually solve or run. So I think that it doesn't hurt Pokemon. It doesn't hurt Studio Ghibli. It doesn't hurt these incumbents. But does it hurt Eric's small indie company who's trying to produce Pokemon number two? And I think that it's less obvious when you're talking about a non-incumbent that doesn't have this brand moat around their product.
Can I frame the,
that everybody
sort of the intellectual property thing from the thing you alluded to earlier, Phil, which is there's this explore-exploit trade-off, basically, in intellectual property development. So you think of, when I say that, it means like everything from patents to new game mechanics to art. Inventor creates an invention. And to get the most social value out of that invention, you want as many people to have access to it as possible, as many people to build on top of it and utilize it as possible and as freely as possible. However, you still need that invention to be created in the first place. And the incentive argument is that the inventor will create the invention if they know they can profit from it. But if the inventor knows they'll create an invention and then immediately someone else is going to steal all the profit and they're going to lose money from it, they won't create the invention in the first place. And so the copyright argument says that you should give the inventor some temporary monopoly control, some way they can extract revenue from it before it gets released to the public so that they continue inventing. And this is, I think, the crux of the intellectual property debate. And as Chris mentioned earlier, it varies by sector to sector. So, for example, for game mechanic, it seems like we're extremely low on that incentive to create. But in a super high R&D industry like pharmaceuticals, like the upfront R&D is massive, but the actual marginal cost of production is negligible. And so they have extremely strong intellectual property protections there. And I think this really boils down to those two things, like, how much do you need to incentivize additional production versus how much do you want to free up access so that as many people can benefit as possible?
And if you just look at the way it's handled in the US, like, we do that. We punish people for... I just watched The Social Network for the first time.
Did that come out like 15 years ago? For the last fucking decade.
Yeah, I can't believe that movie came out 15 years ago.
The film of our generation, I would argue.
It was really good. And I only realized how old it was when they showed the market cap of Facebook at the end. It was like, Facebook is now worth $25
billion. Holy shit,
when was this made? I wish I'd seen this movie. I would have invested. No, it's like the Winklevoss twins. They're all pissed off that their idea was stolen. And they did get compensated for it. And I think that was right. Yeah. And then they went and bought Coin and they're fucking 100 billionaires now. So that seems like a just system to me. And I disagree with this idea that an LLM is no different than an artist honing their skills. I think that you do need to get into the philosophical discussion on whether or not LLMs are conscious. I don't think that they have the ability to actually think and create the way that humans are. I don't think that LLMs are humans. I don't think that AI is human. And so a human creating is fundamentally different than an AI creating. If I use, we talked about this a couple of days ago, if I take a picture of the Mona Lisa, I did not create that image. I didn't create the Mona Lisa. I took a picture of it using a piece of technology. It's a tool that allows me to imitate reality. That's no different than an AI. It's a piece of equipment that somebody built, an engineer built, that emulates the context that you're putting it in. That is not creation. I'm not creating the picture of the Mona Lisa, in my opinion. And so I just think that there's a fundamental flaw in saying that LLMs are creating and iterating in the same way that a human does. A human that goes and trains for 10 years, honing skills, trying to understand classic example is Hermes. They're basically, they train for 10 years so that they can perfectly emulate the previous craftspeople so that they can produce this thing. That's a very different, in my opinion, that is not the equivalent to an AI being trained to create a bag. And indeed, I think we get into the bigger discussion, we also touched this topic of the creator matters. The person who created the thing matters. I want a Hermes bag that was created by an artisan. I don't want an Hermes bag that was created by some machine that stitched it together.
I agree with all these frameworks. Like, I think this makes sense. I think we're after the same thing, which is like, what is the profit maximizing framework?
Crazy thing you said to me is that production is totally price inelastic, as you said, right? You're saying people are going to create stuff no matter the profit motive, which just sounds
actively inelastic. I wouldn't say perfectly inelastic. I can't argue. That means I wouldn't be at the margin. But I would say like relatively inelastic. I think human beings will, like, let's think about it this way. What is copyright? 70 years?
Okay. Right, all right. That,
what would we bet the change in relative output is if we brought it down to, let's say, 40?
I'm all on board with that. I think there's been regulatory capture and corruption, and like, we can get into that more, but.
So what do you think the optimal number is then?
I'd give it like 20 years.
I don't know. I'm around it.
Dude, I would actually say 5 years.
Oh,
if you can't get yourself a moat and you can't build the brand, and you can't, basically what we want to avoid is intellectual theft. Yes. So we want you to be able to build a brand like Pokemon before somebody else can come and steal it. I think that's what we know, that nobody's going to be able to come in and compete with Pokemon in creating Pokemon, right? Pokemon is the best at doing that. What we're trying to avoid is a situation where some unknown artist gets their art stolen or something like that. And I'm of the belief that if you're not able to create a brand for yourself, such that somebody can't come in and do what you're doing better after 5 years. If we were to choose a time period, I don't understand why.
So I
we need
it's
these 40-year time horizons
of Disney, that there's been a regulatory capture, and Disney famously kept extending the copyright deadline, keeping Mickey Mouse under their intellectual property protection. At this point, Mickey Mouse is like almost 100 years old, and famously Steamboat Willie went into public domain a few years ago. But they finagled it so that Steamboat Willie is not the same as Mickey Mouse. And so Steamboat Willie went into public domain, but Disney still owns Mickey Mouse. And it's, I don't know, it's deeply hypocritical because they built their empire off of public domain IPs, Snow White and Cinderella, right? And Sleeping Beauty. And now they're like, oh, no one else is allowed to touch the stuff we made, like Hans Christian Andersen or whoever the fuck, ages ago.
Would the world be better off if they didn't have these 100-year-long protections? Would Disney be better off? Or worse off.
We're all on board that it's too long, and that the system would be better off if, especially at least art and literature, intellectual property was weaker, much weaker than it is today.
And I'm not as convinced that Disney would be worse off as you may imagine, Chris. Like, I think it's a little bit harder in the entertainment sector, but if we imagine like technology and getting rid of patents, another company having a breakthrough again because you had a patent, because they stood on top of your patent, comes back and people recurse the value back to you. So there's a lot of positive externalities that happen in these exchanges too, all the time.
Oh, like pharmaceuticals. Yeah. Imagine if we had like unlimited supply of certain pharmaceuticals that are patented and only allowed to be produced by specific government issued companies.
I would argue like very little from what I think we understand from economic research of the total value of an invention goes back to the creator. Like it's a very small percentage of total revenue of their invention. Hmm. What I'm saying is, I think if you guys think the incentive, if you're skeptical of my inelastic supply argument, they should capture a lot more of their value.
Wait, how?
A different schema. I would argue that if you think that the supply is very elastic, like we want to know what those effects are.
I think that like founders in Silicon Valley and VCs, the people who are really generating, I don't know, I'm not talking about art, but those people are pretty inelastic. If the incentives were to decrease,
let's say we're only giving them 3% of the GDP they create. I think if you guys are true copyrightists and you think the supply side effect is large, I think you want to give them 10% because they're going to make so much more shit if you give them 10% of GDP rather than 5. So I throw it back to you.
Sorry, can you say that again?
I didn't understand. You guys should increase it. My argument that I was making previously is that the supply side response to a change and the expected wage of the copyright issue, like me creating an IP, is not going to do much to the total supply of IP that's created. That's my argument, because it's a relatively inelastic supply curve. But if you disagree with me and you think the supply curve is elastic, what I'm proposing is that we should actually extend the copyright protection, because we will get even more.
So I think there's an optimal point, right?
From
like, I think 70 years on copyright for art is way too long, but I think zero is probably... There's no way the optimal point is at zero for every industry, right? And I think it depends a lot on how much upfront investment is required. I'm going to use pharmaceuticals as an example. Because the ratio and the payoff horizons are so much longer and it's more skewed, they need more protection than game mechanics, for example, might be much quicker. Like you make a hit game, it's popular for a year, you've captured most of your revenue in that first year before someone else can copy it. Maybe you don't need protection for that reason. You're talking about spike and decay curves, revenue earlier.
I think that there's probably like a reasonable midpoint in terms of protections. I reject the idea that LLMs are no different than that creation process is the same as a student iterating on a master's work or something like that. But I think that there's probably a bigger issue with royalty payouts, especially in the context of AI, in that there's no way to properly attribute the output of, that an AI gives to, or even the revenue that an AI produces to an individual contributor without just straight up doing some sort of a split share. Hey, we trained on 10% of the data we trained on is from Studio Ghibli. We made $1 million. Here's $100,000 or something like that.
This is a problem. Some royalty. This is a problem in almost every sort of like network thing or something where there are multiple factors of production. This is a problem in mixed media modeling. For instance, when you have people who like they may have seen an ad on TV and then they purchase something, how much do you attribute to the ad by raising brand awareness versus them seeing like maybe a click through another? Very complicated stuff. And also like on UGC projects, sometimes people will use other people's pre-made objects and they'll add on their own things. And people that I've talked to about the problem of trying to figure out whether or not we should allow that and what the compensation should be, which by the way, makes this a very real policy. This is not just like a pie in the sky thing, guys. Like we could actually run experiments in UGC games where we set different institutional policies about whether or not you're forced to share. And by the way, some UGC platforms do this, like HiPipe, the one out of Finland that's doing like TikTok for mobile. You by default have to have remixes or sharing open so other people can copy all of your work. This
is there any required revenue attribution to the original? Okay, so it's just everything is public domain all the time, basically.
So it does have the effect that you mentioned a really long time ago, Eric, with Fortnite, which is that like people cloned it and almost was like voter median theory. Yeah. But because there's CCU problems and a lot of other things, everyone flocks to one version.
Yeah.
There doesn't end up being like all these copies that survive.
You want to tell it that story like, about that the horror Apex, story doesn't smart ping?
Oh, and then, yeah, that was another one. So to give you an example, Apex Legends had a ping system where if you had your mouse over an object, it would recognize that it was an object and you could click a little mouse button and it would say to your teammates, hey, there's this object here. So you could tell them, go get it or do something. You could ping it. And Fortnite, after that feature launched in Apex, had that in their game. And I think about 2 weeks, we started to see an early version of it. And so that didn't seem to slow innovation either in games. Again, like more people just got all of this really great innovation. It was dispersed really
quickly. So I think the positive version of the story, the anti-copyright version is like, hey, this innovation, everyone is able to use it. All games are better. And that's awesome. The flip side, you see this fast follow strategy where people are like, hey, R&D is hard. Let's just watch other people and fast follow what they do. And if the innovate versus copy incentives are skewed too much, you see a lot of fast follow behavior. And I think we do see that.
I'm not to put you guys on the spot, but can we think of like an example of fast following where the imitator ended up getting the better end of the stick than the innovator? Fortnite.
PUBG, yeah, that was a really great fucking example, Eric.
League of Legends, Dota, Teamfight Tactics, Dotato. There's like dozens of these. Yeah.
Yeah, but would PUBG be that much PUBG's worse off if Fortnite hadn't come in?
I think PUBG is better off because Fortnite. And I guess that's in some ways.
That's what I'm saying. I'm not saying that there wasn't an imitator that was successful. I'm saying that there was an imitator that killed the innovator. And you might even argue because Fortnite popularized that mechanic, that like battle royale, maybe they actually brought people into PUBG. So I think that's a great example, but I think it's actually in favor of no barriers.
I mean, I'm happy with how things turned out. So I guess, going back to the original statement, do we think the games industry needs more or less intellectual property protection? I side with Chris. I side with Phil on this, which is I like the fact that game mechanics aren't copyrighted. I like the fact that these games can see each other and innovate off of each other. And yeah, I do think games are better off for it.
I'm on Phil's side.
Oh my God, Jesus. What the
fuck? To be clear, Phil, my main issue was that you were trying to say that a machine is a human, and I've been saying this for, honestly, since before AI was a big deal. I worked with an AI person a couple of years ago, and they were like, there's no difference between a machine and a human. They're the same. And I was like, that is batshit. I still don't have a super compelling argument for why, but I refute that.
That's the problem, is that we got the naming wrong. To me, it's not artificial intelligence. It's aggregated intelligence. Like, it's the best versions of ourselves. Like, it's been trained like a great master on thousands of years of human history. It is the most human thing we could possibly imagine.
I would call it superhuman.
But I would say that's the struggle, Chris, is like when people don't like that argument, I'm like, where does the analogy fall apart?
So one point I want to get into is, so let's say we actually did want to implement intellectual property protection in games. I think there's actually a huge enforcement problem. One is like the attribution issue that you guys are talking about. Like, even if you wanted to say this artist gets this amount of credit for the AI generated art, like that problem itself is really hard. And also just like regulatory capture and corruption. Like, you guys know about this Inhaler cap lawsuit? So pharmaceuticals, they invent some drug and then it gets a certain amount of lifetime as a patent and then it goes into public domain and you get generic. But pharmaceuticals have been doing all sorts of tricks to extend patent deadlines. There was an inhaler company. They made some inhaler like 100 years ago or whatever that helps with asthma. They invented, air quotes, a special kind of cap on the inhaler. There's like a little button you press that lets it pop off more easily. And they use that little plastic cap as justification for extending their patent and continuing their like monopoly status on this thing, preventing it from going public domain. And pharmaceuticals do all sorts of shit like this where they do dumbass remixes claiming it's a new invention and extending patents. There's a big FTC lawsuit about this, but the point being, even if you have a well-intentioned regulatory apparatus, there's like high chance that it gets corrupted, gets captured, gets abused somehow. And so even if you intended to have like X 5% copyright protection, it ends up getting abused into like much higher.
Yeah. So I think that's interesting in terms of the enforcement on the enforcement level from like a political and legal landscape. Yeah, I think it's a mess, an absolute mess. Convincing judges and politicians that this is stuff that's important, that they should rule in favor of the looser restrictions or paying the royalties, whatever it might be. But there's also just like a pure technical limitation on enforceability. Like, how the fuck do not know what all the data that was used. And Chris in our Game Economist cast Discord channel pointed this out. Do we even know like what ChatGPT has been trained on at this point? We're talking about billions and billions of parameters, which is probably hundreds of billions of data points, if not hitting the trillions. So first of all, we'd have to go back and figure out what these things were trained on in the first place. Second of all, like, how do you regulate what people are using unless you have like very strict government regulations on the data sets that the databases that these guys are pulling from? There's no centralized market for this data. There are many markets for data. AWS has a marketplace for data. You can subscribe to a data stream and literally just have that data stream come into your environment in real time every single day, train your model on that. But that's not necessarily where all of the traffic comes from. So it's technically, there's no real way to figure out what data was used in the first place. It's obvious in the case of ChatGPT using Studio Ghibli stuff because it's okay. They were very overt about it. It's obviously using Studio Ghibli. It wasn't trained on anything else because it's like not coming up with stuff that looks anything other than Studio Ghibli. But there's a lot of cases that are not as clean and cut. And I would not be able to investigate or figure out what ChatGPT has used for their 3.5 model or their 4.0 model. It's like, how do you attribute?
I think there's like a laundering component here. Where imagine like you had to pay for every Studio Ghibli image you fed into the machine. But you could train one machine on some set of Studio Ghibli, you pay the upfront cost. And then you have the Studio Ghibli trained one to generate new images. And then you just bootstrap yourself by training on those Studio Ghibli copyrighted things, but not produced by Studio Ghibli. So yeah, there's a whole enforcement issue.
This is a synthetic data point that like this other guy was making about like, you would never be able to make Studio Ghibli originally if you didn't train on fan art. And fan art in and of itself is a copyright violation. But you could still, I'm sure, argue that we could get AI to make something very close to Studio Ghibli, again, by an artist or someone customizing or prompting it in such an extreme way that it would produce it. In which case, you now have synthetic data that you can train it on, right? So now you got to figure out, is the fucking synthetic data a copyright violation?
That's why I don't think you can do it. So I almost see there are two places where you can employ or calculate the tax. You can either do it on the input side before it's gone into the model, or you can do it on the output side. Basically, hey, you made $10 million this year. You're supposed to pay 10% out to your contributors in royalties. So you pay $1 million split across all of your people. That's like the output side. Input side, do you pay per row of data? And then you've got to price that somehow. And the problem with this data is Studio Ghibli, and I still don't know if it's Ghibli or Ghibli. Studio Ghibli doesn't produce content 24/7. They have these big spikes. Okay, here's a million frames because we just came out with a new movie. All right, 3 years later, here's a million frames. So it's like, how do you price that? So it's input and output. There's no clear way that you could possibly price this stuff.
I agree. All right, do you want to wrap it up? Sounds good. I'll talk soon, guys.
We should teach this to our children. Economics is major. Everyone has to major in economics. Number one, for personal survival. Economics is major.